Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lambcast. I'm your host, Richard Kirkham from Kirkham A Movie A Day and the Strothy Martin Film Project. In history in 1991, Operation Desert Storm launched and the first Gulf War was fought. The Soviet Union came to its end. Jeffrey Dahmer is discovered to have body parts from 11 men in his apartment. Apartheid officially ends in South Africa. Freddie Mercury announces he has AIDS and then dies the next day. And Helmut Kohl and François Mitterrand were still alive, and they were the heads of state of Germany and France in 1991. Unlike this year. In movies, Terminator 2 Judgment Day became one of the landmarks for science fiction action films with its groundbreaking visual effects from Industrial Light and Magic. Walt Disney Pictures releases Beauty and the Beast based on the original fairy tale in Jean Cocteau 1946 film, and it becomes the first animated film ever nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture. In 1991, Ariana DeBose, Austin Butler, and Shailene Woodley are born. In 1991, David Lean, Frank Capra, and Don Siegel passed away. And all of that barely scratches the surface. Welcome to another episode of Decade Look Back, this time featuring the year 1991. Before we get in the Wayback Machine, let's meet the folks who will be seated next to you and doing all the talking. Nicole Ayers from Mad Lab Post is with us this week. Nicole, did you know that Leonardo DiCaprio made his film debut in 1991?
No, I did not, but I love me some Leo, so I'm here for that ride.
Well, then you have to put Critters 3 on your watch list, because that's the film that he made his debut in. Yeah. From Blueprint Review, we have David Brook. Do you think he's an Ed Sheeran fan? Ed was born in 1991, and he's British too, right?
No.
Right, not.
Oh, Will Slater, have any idea how many films in 1991 had exploding helicopters?
You know what? I really should have looked that up, Richard.
By the end of the show, I expect to learn. Heather Baxendale Walsh, did you see Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves for Kevin Costner or Alan Rickman?
Oh, definitely Alan Rickman. Are you out of your mind? I'll cut his heart out with a spoon. Why?
With a spoon.
Dull, you twit. It'll hurt more.
It'll hurt more. Well, everyone was asked to bring five films to talk about today, and how they choose them was completely up to the guests. If you had a system or a theme, we'll hear about it as we start the first round. And we're going to start that first round right now. Heather, what's your first film, and did you have a theme or a reason for picking your films?
Yes, mine was childhood nostalgia. I was 10 years old, and this was a strange age because, you know, you're not quite a child anymore. Not that my parents ever, you know, really censored anything that I watched. I was watching Poltergeist at 3, but and every 80s action movie that was dropped as a child. But you have that cross between, I'm starting to get a little older and can comprehend adult themes more, but still love the things that are childlike. So a lot of these actually fall kind of into that bubble where they're good for children and adults. So I'm going to start off with the most obvious one, Terminator 2. Ah. Okay, maybe that's not such a kid one. But it was for me. Terminator was the movie that made me love movies. It was the movie that made me look at movies as something more than just entertainment. And even as a little kid, I was obsessed with it. It's just a cornerstone for so much of my affection of storytelling in general. And Terminator 2, when it came out, I mean, we had Arnie going, it's the biggest movie of the summer on Arsenio Hall, on all of the late night talk shows. And it was such a big deal. But as a kid, I mean, I had never felt like a movie event before. I never felt like, oh, I'm going to the theater to see this when it opens. And thankfully, my parents, being my parents, they took me and my 7-year-old brother to go see Terminator 2 in the theater opening weekend. And it was a brand new theater. They had just opened it around the corner, and it had air conditioning that worked, y'all. And it was so cold in there. And I remember there was comfy seats and rocking them. I remember that the popcorn tasted better. The movie is brilliant. The movie is still one of my favorite movies of all time. But the experience of it is so rooted in my mind. I can look back and I can feel what it felt like watching it. And the experience in the theater of it, the whole entire crowd reacted. There was nothing on screen like that before, particularly all the special effects. Nobody had seen anything like that ever. When that T-1000 came through the window of the helicopter, when he was using knives and stabbing weapons, and just all of these great effects, and Robert Patrick being absolutely terrifying, the switch of roles between Arnie and then the complexity of the mother protecting the son, and then the future, and then the whole entire time paradox. I mean, it's, and then explosions everywhere. And I mean, it just has everything. It's a perfect movie to me. I love it. It's just.
And how often, awesome. How often do you re-experience it?
Oh, I probably watch it multiple times a year. I never get tired of it ever. And I can replay it from beginning to end in my head without blinking. It's a non-issue. It's just one of those movies for me. It's, and like I said, the experience of seeing it that year as a kid is very much so a cornerstone movie going event. So I may have gone on a bit about it, but there it is.
That's all right. We'll let you do that. But we do want to give anybody else who has an opinion about Terminator 2 that is different from yours to share their opinion. Does anybody have anything to add to Heather's nostalgia bomb here?
I was just going to say, I'm jealous that you got to see it at the cinema. I mean, I was 9 in 1991, so, and in the UK it was rated 15, so I couldn't watch it at the cinema. But I can always remember my babysitter at the time watched it, and me and my brother were so excited. She was telling us about it. Like, oh, it sounds amazing. And we actually did have some Terminator 2 like bubblegum cards or like stickers or something, which is like cool. And it's just like, yeah. But I didn't get to watch it for another 2-3 years later when it was on VHS. But yeah, I'm with you though. It is an amazing film. I love that movie.
Well, it's nice to be embraced by nostalgia, and Terminator 2 is full of it. I mean, you know, and full of Arnie. So everybody likes that kind of stuff. Nicole, what kind of stuff do you like, and why did you pick the things that you picked?
I like Heather, I think I went for nostalgia, but I tried to go with a little bit of a theme. So I picked one movie from a different genre. And I wasn't old enough to watch a lot of the movies that are on my list to talk about. And so I don't think I've seen any of them in the movie theater. I saw these movies either on TV or on VHS. My mother thankfully had a little movie collection on VHS, and my relatives had cable TV. So that's how I snuck and saw some of the PG-13 and R-rated movies in the early 90s. Terminator 2, Judgment Day, was actually my number two pick on my list for the sci-fi genre. So I guess I'll just piggyback on that pick for my number two. For the sci-fi, Terminator 2, I chose that film because it's one of my favorite Terminator movies so far. I say so far because I haven't seen all of them yet. And I love Arnold Schwarzenegger movies when I was a kid. And I actually covered the special effects in this film in a school report back when I was in college. I forget the class that I had. I think it was like a post-production or editing. It was for my special effects class, interestingly enough. I had to do a report, and I decided to write about the liquid metal in the movie and compare it to similar special effects that showed up in other films and in other media, such as the music video. There's the rapper Busta Rhymes has a song called What's It Gonna Be. In the music video for that song, Janet Jackson appears in the movie, in the music video, and she kind of melts or something.
Yeah,
and
she does.
Yeah, and then she appears again in that liquid. And so I that was part of the report that I had, that I did with Terminator 2 Judgment Day and the special effects. I also liked that Sarah Connor was really badass in this film, or at least that was my interpretation.
Oh, no, you're right. That's a fact.
As a little girl watching this, watching this movie, and seeing her, I was just like, oh, okay, she can make it. Like, I want to be like her. And I liked some of the funny one-liners in it. And I also liked that instead of being the villain in the sequel, Arnold Schwarzenegger, his character became one of the good guys, you know, trying to go up against this new highly developed advanced technology. And so
there's a lot of Terminator 2 love on this show. James Cameron is going to be very happy to hear us when he listens.
No, he is. I'll call him. I have him on speed dial. I'm not supposed to anymore, but I do anyway.
He has a restraining order on you. Is that it?
Don't tell anyone. Shh.
Will, as I recall, there is an exploding helicopter in Terminator 2.
There certainly is.
Did you have any other thoughts before I ask you what your first film is and what if you had a theme for today's show?
I just really echo what others have said here, you know, about Terminator 2. It was a fantastic film, and I remember it coming out, and I really remember it being like a real event movie as well, because obviously, you know, you had all sorts of sort of marketing going on around associated with the film, and then obviously you had that Guns N' Roses track as well, which was like released as part of the marketing push around that film. So it was a big event, and it sort of set I think a sort of new standard really in probably in sequels, or certainly in action sequels anyway. James Cameron's definitely got a good reputation when it comes to doing action movie sequels, and I think some filmmakers today could do with trying to put the same
tutoring.
Level of craft. Yeah, a little tutoring, try and put the same level of craft that he put into the sort of the sequels that he did. But do you want to go into my segue? So, well, I decided to go for a theme because I just thought it would be more interesting, and I had a look back through my highest rated movies from 1991, and I noticed that quite a few of them fell into a particular genre. And as anyone sort of heard me sort of podcast before, they probably know that I am a big film noir fan, and quite a lot of the films that I had sort of rated quite highly that came out in 1991 are films that you could describe as neo-noirs. So I have selected five films that fit within that particular genre. So the first film that I'm going to give a mention to is The Last Boy Scout, the Tony Scott directed, Shane Black scripted buddy movie thriller. You got a very good turn here from Bruce Willis as the washed up private eye who finds himself embroiled in this conspiracy involving drugs, murder, gambling, and in the classic tradition of conspiracy goes all the way to the top. I think the thing that really makes this film is Bruce Willis's chemistry with Damon Wayans. They make a great bickering double act, and I think Willis is he's just really suited to this role or this type of role, because he can do the tough guy bit in a sort of Humphrey Bogart type of way, but he's also got the comedy chops to deliver the one-liners and the comedy beats that are in this film. And looking back now, I think you can see a lot of Shane Black-isms within this particular film. There's a sort of structure or a sort of formula that he's repeated quite often sort of in the years since, with things like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang or The Nice Guys. You've got a couple of great supporting actor turns in this film that I really love, and you've got Taylor Negron as Milo, and then you've got Kim Coates, who I think is only in this film for about 3 minutes at most, but it is it's like the best 3 minute. I mean, 3 minutes. It just sears, that scene just sears itself into your brain through solely through his performance. I mean, it's a fantastic little bit role that he has there. You know, famously, The Last Boy Scout was the most expensive script at the time that had ever been like sold in Hollywood. Shane Black was, you know, testament to the how hot a property he was, you know, coming in off the back of like Predator and the Lethal Weapons film. And whilst, you know, I have to say this film probably doesn't live up to that sort of level. I don't think it's Tony Scott's best film. I don't think it's Shane Black's best film, but this is still a hugely enjoyable movie. And yeah, I've got no qualms, despite having, you know, a few reservations about it. I got no qualms in recommending this one to anyone.
Nice. Yeah, I'm glad you picked this one, actually, because I rewatched this for the podcast. It's not on my list. It doesn't fit my theme. But when I kind of brought up a list of films that I could think about watching, and that came in, I was like, yes, I haven't seen it for ages. But I'm really glad as well that you picked it as a neo-noir thing, because that's one thing that I took from this rewatch, is I haven't seen it for God knows how long. But in my memory, I always think Bruce Willis, I think Shane Black, I think, oh yeah, it's an action movie. But yeah, I totally, on this rewatch, totally got that film noir vibe, and which I very much appreciate. So yeah, nice choice.
It was one of the ones I was considering too. I actually rewatched it for the first time maybe about a year ago, in a long, long time. I think I was doing it for actually a Tony Scott show, but yeah, it's interesting because the dichotomy of the Shane Black influence and Tony Scott, and they're not, and they, I don't feel like they necessarily should mesh well together, but they do. And then we have the epitome of the buddy cop timeline. Right in this little crux here. I mean, this is the time where buddy cop movies were everything. So I think sometimes it might, now that time has passed, it doesn't show up as significantly as other ones. And I think maybe it's gotten lost in the shuffle a little bit. But rewatching it, it has a lot of great scenes in it. It has great dialogue. The action's fantastic. And like you said, the chemistry between Damon Wayans and Bruce Willis is just wonderful. But it is, I think it holds up pretty well. Not perfect or anything, but it's a great watch.
This is one of those that I like and dislike depending upon when I last saw it. My opinion changes about it. Sometimes I watch it and say, well, that was a lot of fun, and other times I watch it and say, that was a complete mess, what the hell was going on here? And I'm not sure why it affects me differently each time I see it, but I do know that there have been plenty of times when I've enjoyed some of the sequences. I did like the idea of the football player, and by the way, we're recording this on Super Bowl Sunday, so I did like the idea that he's absolutely going to score, and you know, if he requires him to take out his 45 and shoot the linebackers, that's going to happen. I hope we don't see that in today's game, but I do remember that scene. Well, David,
I think we're probably only 30 years away from that actually becoming sort of.
You know, yeah, we're down the road from, you know, that. You know, I think Rollerball is still in our future.
I'm for it, okay? I know it ends badly in every movie it's ever in, but I don't care.
David, you're up next. Did you have a theme, an approach?
I did. I mean, on a loose level, it is my usual approach of I bring up my database of unwatched movies in my DVD collection and say, right, what can I finally get to watch? Because I use this show as an excuse to get through them. But when I brought up my list this time, it was huge. I've got a lot of films from 1991, which is great. When I kind of scrolled down to see what there was, I did spot kind of a bit of a recurring theme in there, and that is low-budget movies, and I mean really low-budget movies. And I think with 1991, this is early 90s, is when the director video market was really booming, because VHS was a real big thing by that point. Also, advancements in kind of home video recording had boomed, so you were getting this kind of shot on video market going and things like that. So you're getting a lot of people making films for very little and having a market for them, even if they didn't make the cinema. At least they could go out on video, which is, I imagine, a heck of a lot cheaper. So you got this boom of kind of super independent films being made. So I thought, I'm going to hit that. They vary. I've got some super micro budget stuff and some things that maybe cost a little bit more. But yeah, I found five that I was going to go with. First up, I'm going to talk about a really low budget, micro budget film called Atlantis. So this was made by a British director called Michael J. Murphy. He's someone I had not really heard of, and he's a guy who he just kept plowing through the industry, making his own little movies with friends and kind of amateur dramatic, kind of local amateur dramatic societies. But he just kept at it, and he made films up until he died quite fairly young. I think he was in his mid-60s, I think. But he'd started from when he was a kid, just kept on making movies every few years. And he never really had a lot of success. He had one or two films that kind of made a minor splash on the direct-to-video market. But a lot of the films just disappeared. But it's recently, though, Indicator in the UK, one of the Blu-ray labels in the UK, released a... And actually, they're released in the US as well now. They released a box set with all his surviving work. It's a very odd choice because, as I say, no one's heard of the guy. But they brought him out, and I got all this box set. Yes, I was intrigued. I'm interested in these kind of super low-budget stuff, because even if the films are quite often not that good, and as we'll go through my list today, most of the films aren't that good. But there's a charm about it, and I appreciate it. I've made low-budget films myself, and so I can really, really feel for these filmmakers, given it all they've got. It takes a lot of guts. It takes a lot of dedication to kind of get kind of work weekends and every spare minute you've got to put a whole feature film together and then try and get it out there. So Atlantis is one of these super, super low budget ones. It's what I kind of is impressive about this one is it's micro budget cost. I don't know the actual budget, but I'm thinking a few hundred pounds or something, maybe 2,000 if I'm looking. But it's a fantasy epic. Like, it's set in Atlantis. You've got this like sword and sorcery going on, and the sets and the costumes are horrendous, but he was going for it. Like, he was just trying, and you've got to give him props for that. The story, I watched this a few weeks ago, I'm trying to remember what the story was, but basically there's kind of two worlds. You've got the people above land and you've got the people below in Atlantis, and there's this kind of evil kind of warlord guy down below, and he kidnaps kidnaps people from the top and uses them as slaves, and when the slaves are useless, he grinds them up into protein shakes that he gives to his slaves. And it's schlocky, it's naff, and but you know what, it's easy to dismiss this as like a low grade trash, and it's easy, and but I went with it, and not just in a so bad it's good vibe. I mean, there was that going on there. I was laughing at bits because it was so kind of naff. But you know what? Considering how little money it had, it had like an energy to it. It was bizarrely engrossing. Like, even the story wasn't particularly original or anything. It kind of kept me hooked. I was interested in what was going on. It didn't really waste a frame. It just got on with things, which is more than you can say for a lot of kind of low budget movies. And It was fun. It is not a good film, but I enjoyed my time with it. But anyway, that's it.
Now, did you watch it on VHS?
No, as I say, I've got this fancy Blu-ray box set, which is bizarre.
Although, I have nothing but respect for that. I love low-budget fantasy and sci-fi, so you're preaching to the right crowd here.
Funnily enough, though, this wasn't one shot on video. Like, it is actually shot on film. It's like 16mm or something like that, but... I was surprised by actually a lot of the films I picked out. I assumed some were shot on video, but I don't think any of them were in the end. But yeah, anyway.
Well, thank you for reminding us or introducing us to that obscurity. That's fun. Is there a chance that anybody else has seen this movie?
No.
I just thought I'd ask, you know, what the heck?
You need to have got that box. I think it's the only time it's been released ever, to be honest.
I've obviously never heard of this film, but I've just been looking it up online, and I see that the sort of the Atlantis, well, basically I see that the inside of a hospital in Portsmouth was doubling for the interiors of Atlantis, which is
it was the small wing of a psychiatric hospital. I think they say that there's some really good special features on there. It's the director admits that this was quite silly and schlocky, and that he didn't care. He was just making something fun, really, that he thought was marketable.
Well, it's I'm glad that we're going to be getting more of these in the next few minutes, because it sounds like you had a lot of fun digging into your say trash bin, your bin of your bin of unwatched. And that's a good theme to have. I have a similar kind of theme here. By the way, everything is nostalgia for me, because I saw all of these things in 1991 in a theater. So it's always fun to kind of relive those experiences. But I kind of picked films that are largely forgotten that I own on Laserdisc. So I decided to watch them all on Laserdisc this week, and I went through that process. I still have a working machine. I still have my laser discs. So I went through and said, okay, what have I got from 1991 that is not necessarily on everybody's, you know, list? What are they unlikely to find? I think that I'm going to end up with Will having one overlap on one of mine. But my first one, I don't think anybody will have. Scenes from a Mall. Has anybody even heard of this?
Nope.
Unless
I have. It rings a bell. Oh,
okay, it's a Woody Allen film that Woody Allen did not direct or write. And he stars with Bette Midler.
Oh.
It's a Paul Mazursky film. And Woody and Bette play a married couple celebrating what is either their 16th anniversary or their 17th, because that's part of the dispute. Do they count the year they lived together before they got married as a year in their anniversary? They both are acknowledging that there have been infidelities in their marriage. And they do this while they are shopping at the mall at Christmas time and picking out gifts. And it's, of course, full of contentiousness and full of witticisms, and Woody Allen is basically playing, as usual, Woody Allen, and he is muttering comments to himself and about everything else. If he didn't write it, but he might as well have, because it's very much a Woody Allen style character. And Bette Midler is a little over the top, but she plays very sympathetically at the first part of the film, and then later in the film she gets a chance to overdo it a bit. And of course it all takes place in a mall. They apparently shot it in three or four different mall locations, plus they created a big set to be able to shoot in. And they are the two main characters. They have two children that go off and leave in the first 3 minutes of the film, so we never see them again, except we hear them phone calls being made to them, but we never hear or see from them again. There aren't any other regular characters except a mime who is at the mall performing and frequently irritates and mimics them. So it's kind of interesting. And I was amused by the fact that the mime is played by Bill Irwin, who I know from CSI playing the serial killer that they followed in one of the seasons. And I'm going, serial killer mime. That sounds like a good movie, too. Why don't we have that? I'm kind of a fan of Paul Mazursky. I think his best film is Moscow on the Hudson. And he's made a lot of these other, you know, kind of, I tell you what, they are definitely Woody Allen adjacent kinds of films. To me, one of the most amusing parts of this is at the very beginning, when Woody is talking to Bette as his wife, and he's talking about one of the other people that they've invited over, and he's making, you know, snide comments about the guy who's always saying that how New York is the cultural center of the world and Los Angeles is a wasteland, and he doesn't want to hear any of that crap. And I thought, that is so meta, it's ridiculous, because that's exactly what Woody did in all of his movies. So I thought that was a lot of fun.
That does sound fun. And Bette Midler's in it, and I haven't seen it or heard of it, which is kind of weird. I love Bette Midler, and I watched every Bette Midler movie I could when I was a kid with my mom. So now I'm interested.
Well, I tell you what, it's kind of an odd movie, and they walk around with a surfboard under their arm for three quarters of the film, so it's. I won't explain it. If you ever get a chance to see it, you'll just enjoy it the way it happens there.
Is it available on any other format now other than Laserdisc, Richard?
I'm sure it's available somewhere. I'd have to look. Let me see. I got to check. Let me check my Just Watch, because I didn't even look at anything else. That, like I said, that was my filter that I was using.
There's a Blu-ray.
There is. Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
Good to know modern formats are available.
Yes. You can get it on a double bill feature with Big Business. I remember seeing that.
There you go. That's right. I've seen that.
Richard really wants to bring back Laserdisc, and he is doing everything in his power, and I respect it.
Nice.
Oh, the online communities for the Laserdisc format are just ridiculous. These people are nuts. You know, I am an outlier because I'm just kind of interested in the movies and the packaging and the formatting. They're the ones who are all into making sure that you've got the right modulator, you've got the right sound system, you've got the right filters in there. You know, and of course, if you're not watching it on a plasma TV, you are wasting all of your time. Yeah, you can rent it on Apple TV. If you don't want to dig out that double feature Blu-ray. Heather, we're back to you. What's your second film?
We are, and this one is not going to surprise a single person. It is Drop Dead Fred. Okay, there are two movies in my family, and by my family, I mean my brother and I, his son, me, and my dragons. And there are two movies in both of our families that you have to love, or we will not invite you into our lives. And one of them is Milo and Otis, and the other one is Drop Dead Fred. If you don't like them, then we give you away. Drop Dead Fred, I was 10 when it came out. So it feels like and looks like it's a child's movie. But now that I'm an adult, I feel like this is so much more of an adult journey. Of looking at your childhood life and looking at your young self and kind of dealing with all of your childhood trauma and moving on and growing up. It's actually kind of a beautiful coming of age movie. It is, guys. It's also full of disgusting jokes and very, very grotesque humor and tons of slapstick comedy. But it has a great cast too. Phoebe Cates is so, so absolutely adorable in this. Rick Mail is so funny. So funny. I don't think I've ever laughed as hard. And Marsha Mason is just vicious as the mega bitch. It's the mega bitch! That's my mom, too. I understand. Tim Matheson was such a slimy, slick little creep in it. And Carrie Fisher was the best friend in the whole world. I'm like, your friend's imaginary friend as an adult sunk your ship and you're cool with it. It is. It's a silly movie. Oh yeah, and even Ron Eldard's in it, and he plays this sweet, sweet, sweet nice guy who also kind of just indulges our main character Elizabeth. I don't know what attracted to me so much as a kid, but the first time I watched it, I was instantly in love. I was Snotface. I still am Snotface. Let's play burglar Snotface. All of my children can recite this movie. All of them. My brother can, my nephew can, because I used to babysit my nephew. And then I'd be like, what do you want to watch? I don't know. Let's watch Drop Dead Fred. Okay. I have watched this movie probably 100 times, maybe double that. It's completely possible. Every aspect of it still makes me laugh out loud, the belly laugh into my core and my heart. I'm not objective as to whether or not it's actually a good movie. I love it way too much to be in any way, shape, or form understanding of whether or not it is. It could be an awesomely bad movie for all I know, but I absolutely adore it. It's in my favorites forever and ever and ever.
Well, somehow, I've not seen this film, but
I was just going to say.
I am aware of it, and from what I understand, but I wonder if, I mean, Heather, have you ever seen a Rick Mail TV series called Bottom?
I have been told many times that I need to watch it.
Oh, so, yes. I wonder. I don't know. As I say, I've not seen it, but it sounds as if the sort of style of humor is very similar. I don't know if anyone is. I don't know, David.
I have seen Drop Dead Fred, but it's not since like 1993 or something. I can't remember enough about it. I can remember it being quite gross, like most of, like a lot of Rick Mail stuff. Like Bottom, definitely, it has a bit of that Bottom vibe. Didn't they do a Bottom film? No, it wasn't a Bottom film. It was
The stage house thing.
Guest that... House Paradiso. No, it was kind of a similar kind of feel. I don't know if you've seen that one. But yeah, because Rick Mayles was a household name in the UK back in the 80s and 90s, really. So I don't. Did any of his TV stuff kind of get to the UK, to the US? I don't know.
No, not really. And I didn't fully.
He was in one series that played here, and I'm trying to remember what it was. It was
The Young Ones. That's it. And The New Statesman. He did quite a lot of stuff. He's a bit of a legend in the UK.
I can see why. He's absolutely brilliant. His physical comedy, the voice work that he does, and yes, all of the disgusting stuff. I don't generally like that kind of thing. He made me love it. Love it. He is the heart. He is the heart of the movie. He makes it work. They were going to remake it many years ago, and they've talked about it since then too. And they were going to do it with Russell Brand, and I'm like, do not.
No.
Don't you dare. Don't you dare.
That's not getting made now. That's for sure.
No, it's not.
I'm gonna save this and watch it on the day before that I go see If later this year.
Wonderful. This is also a movie that I have submitted to Movie of the Month probably like 10 times. Just because I want to talk about it. And I don't know anybody who wants to talk about it with me.
Well,
so.
put it on your May calendar and maybe we can make it Movie of the Month.
I will.
Nicole, what have you got for us next?
Next up, after crossing the sci-fi genre off of my list, my next pick is in the crime film genre, and it is New Jack City, directed by Mario Van Peebles, who also stars in the film as an undercover police detective. I'm sure most people are familiar with this, but for anyone listening out there who's living in a cave somewhere, New Jack City is a movie about a crime lord named Nino Brown, who runs a drug empire with his best friend named G Money. And together with their top shooter named Keisha and several other people on their payroll, they're known as the Cash Money Brothers or CMB Gang, wreaking havoc on the Harlem neighborhood in New York. Now, I've seen this movie so many times that I don't remember when I first saw it. Because due to the rating, I was too young to watch it in the theater, most likely, but I've seen it, when visiting, family members and friends, and, people did own this when I was growing up, so I could watch it at my leisure, which I enjoyed. I have New Jack City on VHS currently, so I'm gonna have to upgrade that to DVD eventually. But I chose the movie because it's one of my favorite movies from the 90s, and it's also one of my favorite movies of all time. After premiering at Sundance in 1991, I didn't know until recently that New Jack City went on to become the top grossing independent film of that year and remains a cult classic among genre films in this particular category. It's, not surprising that comedian Chris Rock and rapper Ice-T were already known when the movie came out, but I'm sure Wesley Snipes and Alan Payne's careers were given a boost after their appearance in this movie. There are also several other recognizable people in the film, including some R&B musicians like Keith Sweat and Teddy Riley, who make an appearance. New Jack City for me is a favorite because when I was younger and I watched it, I just thought it was funny, even though it was really violent, because I liked a lot of the dialogue or the one-liners. But I also think that it teaches viewers a harsh lesson, where there's a saying that like blood is thicker than water. In the case of this movie, it seems that green paper is thicker than blood. I think that G Money, the character G Money, played by Alan Payne, should he learned a very hard lesson about like not getting high on your own supply. For those who in the inner city, I shall say, that is a statement that I heard growing up. I went to one of the high schools that I went to before my mother pulled me out of it. There were some students in there that claimed that they were in gangs and things like that. And I heard that line, never get high on your own supply, but I didn't always know what that meant. And over time I came to realize that it meant like, okay, like if you're selling drugs, don't use the drugs, or if you're involved in alcohol or something, don't consume that. And unfortunately in this movie, you know, one of the best friends, you know, his life takes a little dive, and that creates a lot of conflict between those two. But that's not even my favorite. As I'm talking about it, I can see the movie in my head, and I'm sure this wouldn't be a law that would be passed, or like, I'm sure there are a lot of human resource departments would not implement this. But I do like the fact that Nino required people to work in the nude. For those who haven't seen New Jack City, there's a crackhead named Pookie, played by Chris Rock, who describes Nino's drug empire. And he has people stuffing these little crack pipes or vials or whatever they're called. The people that are working for him, they're all in this room naked, you know, creating his product. He does not trust anyone, to the point where you can't even wear clothes when you work for him. Now, I don't know if I have trust issues, but I loved it. I thought that was brilliant when I saw the movie. Like, damn, you can't steal from this man. You have to be naked when you're working for him. And that is brutal. And so I don't think that's something that would fly in the U.S., but I thought that was interesting that people were also willing to work for him even though he had that requirement. That's a scene that always stood out for me, as well as the soundtrack. There's a song called I Wanna Sex You Up by the group Color Me Bad. That was a pretty cool song, and I think that Nino, played by Wesley Snipes, had some of the coolest dialogue in the movie. One being, sit your $5 ass down before I make change. I always thought that was really, really funny for some odd reason. But yet to this day, I still don't understand the champagne scene where he pours champagne on his girlfriend while she's yelling at him. And he tells his goons to cancel that hoe. And over time, I wondered if that meant like, was he ordering someone to kill her? But she still shows up in the movie after that scene. So I always wondered what that meant. Like, what is the purpose of like pouring champagne on someone's head and then telling your goons to cancel that cancel that hoe? If someone out there can let me know. That is something that I've wondered ever since I was a little girl. So there's that.
This show can have any utility whatsoever, it's in answering those kinds of questions.
Yes,
for our
guests. Know,
so people out there, if you know the answer to this, make sure that you contact us so that we can share it with Nicole.
Yes, or even if you have a theory. Like, that was something that I always wondered. But the line, rock-a-bye baby, and am I my brother's keeper, those are two lines that have always been something that my friends and I, or family have used in conversations about other topics. But I also found out recently that I didn't know, according to The Source, which is a magazine covering hip hop music, the record label Cash Money Records is named after the Nino Brown character's Cash Money Brothers gang from the movie. And for those that don't listen to rap music, Cash Money Records is owned by two real-life brothers, a record executive and another record exec and rapper known as Birdman, a.k.a. Baby. And now Birdman went on to mentor a rapper named Lil Wayne, who was also signed by Cash Money Records. Lil Wayne's Carter albums are said to, in addition to being self-titled albums, they're also said to be a homage to the Carter apartment complex, which is the high-rise building that Nino Brown turned into the crack house in the movie. And so I thought that that was interesting. It seems like life is imitating art in a whole bunch of other ways as well, because Lil Wayne has been fighting with Birdman over the rights to his music, but hopefully it won't end the same way that it ended in the movie.
Well, it is the rap hip-hop industry, so it might very well end up that way.
Yes.
Sorry about that.
Yes. And it goes to show the lesson of how, like, in the movie, Wesley Snipes, the Nino Brown character in the movie becomes this egomaniac of sorts. And I hope that in real life, I hope that Birdman doesn't become an egomaniac and just give Lil Wayne his money and let him out of the, you know, let him out of the contract or whatever. Just give him what he wants.
Well, I'm not going to take sides in any of those disputes financially between rap musicians and entrepreneurs, but I will point out that we do have other egomaniacs on the show, and Will is sitting right there waiting to give his next film. So, Will, what have you got up next?
So the next film I've got is a film called Homicide, which is written and directed by David Mamet. And ostensibly, this is a cop thriller. That's what it looks like on the surface. But really, this is a drama about personal identity. So you've got Joe Mantegna playing a police detective who is reluctantly assigned to investigate the death of this elderly Jewish shopkeeper. Now, the wrinkle here is that Mantegna's character is a lapsed Jew, and he's kind of allowed his sort of personal, his sort of identity as a Jewish man to be sort of subsumed by his cop identity. And but sort of over the course of the investigation, which, you know, starts to appear as if this is not just a sort of simple robbery, that this sort of murder, this death, there's something bigger behind it, sort of Mantegna starts to sort of reconnect with his own Jewish identity. Now, this was Mamet's third film that he had written and directed after House of Games and Things Change, although he had obviously written for the screen quite a lot previously, done the scripts for The Untouchables and for the Paul Newman great legal thriller The Verdict. But sort of, yeah, this film, you have a lot of the same cast, though, that had been in Mehmet's sort of the previous two films that he directed. So you've got Joe Mantegna, William H. Macy. You've got people like your sort of faces that you'd know them if you see them. People like J.J. Johnston, Ricky Jay, Vincent Gustafero. And these were all actors that Mehmet had, you know, because obviously he's ostensibly a playwright who then sort of moved into the world of film. He'd actually worked with a lot of these guys in theatre. And it's really down to Mehmet, actually, that sort of, you know, some of these guys became the sort of, I mean, they probably would have, you know, become screen actors anyway, but it was, you know, he was giving them these very prominent roles, which certainly, you know, they, other people sort of thought, hey, look, you know, look what William H. Macy's doing in this film. We should, you know, we should get him in for this gig. I like this film a lot. It's like, you know, it's really interesting to see David Mamet playing in a kind of police movie sandbox here. So you have, I mean, his trademark as a playwright is this sort of overlapping, hard-boiled sort of staccato dialogue, and it's, you know, which is works like brilliantly within the sort of milieu of a cop movie. Again, this isn't a perfect film. There are some I got some major problems with this film. The third act is really not great. It kind of feels like Mamet is wanting to make a grand statement, but he can't quite pull the threads together of the plot. So the film does. It feels like it's building to something, and then it just sort of dissipates a bit towards the end, and it does end a little disappointingly. But if you want to see some great actors in a cop film, and if you want to see a cop film that's about something more than just somebody finding a murderer, then yeah, check out Homicide.
I saw this movie in 1991. I can remember the theater that I went to. It was a rainy day. I remember nothing about the movie. It is terrible the way that my frickin' memory works. Why I can recall the Colorado Theater on Colorado Boulevard in Pasadena and going to see this movie and it being wet outside and rainy. And I think I'd look forward to it because I was a big fan of House of Games. And I cannot remember anything, but I am a fan of Joe Mantegna, so this is another one I'm going to have to revisit. Excellent. I'm glad that we've got films like that on our list. David, what interesting film did you find?
Well, I'm going to bring the tone down a bit now. And I'm going to talk about Do or Die. So Do or Die is from the great mind of Andy Sedaris. If you don't know Andy Sedaris, he is a film director who's famous for casting his films by brass eyes rather than a talent, and he makes super trashy films with attractive people, lots of guns, lots of explosions, and he does it on the cheap. I mean, this one is probably one of the more expensive ones, almost certainly the most expensive one I'm going to talk about today. But still, I thought I'd let it slide because it was straight to video, presumably less than a million still. Although this one, I must admit, compared to most of Andy Sedaris' films, I did worry it was too expensive because it does have two known actors in this one. So we have Eric Estrada and we have Pat Morita, that's it. So I think a lot of the films I've seen of his don't have any kind of known names in there. So this rose it up to made it rise up to another level, but not so far to another level. This is still pure trash. Andy Sedaris knows what the audience wants, and he just gives it. And so this story on this film is it just does that. It's just a very simple setup just to allow as many explosions and gratuitous sex scenes as possible. So basically what happens is, Pat Morita, he kidnaps these two ladies, Donna and Nicole, and they're some kind of super secret agent, FBI kind of type ladies, and he's annoyed with them. They've done something to him in the past, I'm not quite sure what, and he says, right ladies, I've kidnapped you now, but I'm gonna let you go, but I'm sending out six teams of the ultimate assassins to kill you guys one at a time. You have to survive. So basically, it's just like a game, and he even has his beautiful assistant, obviously a young lady assistant who has like a computer, like a video game thing, which loads up who the next team is on this. And obviously, this is 1991, so it's really comedy, kind of dodgy computer graphics, and that's it. It's six groups of assassins try to kill these ladies, and it's just. But you know what? I really enjoyed this. It does run out of steam. There's very little connective tissue. It is just an excuse for boobs, explosions, car chases, boat chases. And as much as I love a good car, boat, helicopter, whatever chase, it did run out of steam by the end. It kind of fizzles out a bit. But for the most part, this film had me. Plus, it doesn't take itself seriously. I mean, again, Sedaris, he knows what he's doing, and he knows it's not supposed to be taken seriously. He doesn't want to go too far into plot. And so there's a lot of really daft lines in there. And I think one character at one point says, I'm going to blow their tits off. And it's just this is the kind of thing you're playing with. So, yeah, it's if you want some pure, low, ultra lowbrow kind of material, this is. Although I would say, as I say, obviously his films in general are terrible for objectifying women. But, you've got to give it kind of credit for having two female leads kicking lots of ass. They are the absolute leads here. They are doing all the kind of dirty work. And so I will give him props for that, even if there's way too much nudity in the film. But yeah, if you're in the right frame of mind, it's fun.
It's like an asylum movie where you're just watching sometimes and you're like, oh, I forgot this is an asylum movie. There's actually a movie happening, and then just a random boob pops out. Like, just had to remind you it's an asylum movie. We have to have boobs somewhere.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a decent time killer, but I don't think it's Sidaris's best or most inspired.
It's
work.
No hard ticket to Hawaii.
No.
Well, my next film is one that kind of fits into the categories that Will has. It's a neo-noir, although it would actually also be a noir because part of it is set back in the 1940s. It's Dead Again with Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson. A film that was pretty successful in its time, but I don't hear many people talking about it. And they both play dual roles as characters from the 1991 period and from the post-war period in Los Angeles. A murder has taken place back in 1947, and a composer has murdered his cellist wife, and it's big news, and he's executed ultimately, but there's a journalist that was involved in the whole thing. And I remembered this movie and enjoying it, and I know I've seen it a couple of times since, but I never remember exactly what the plot is until I start watching it, and then I go, oh yeah, now I remember what happened. And it's full of callbacks to the earlier story. It's kind of a supernatural film as well, because obviously we are dealing with characters who are supposedly reborn into new bodies, personas, human beings, starting life again. This is past lives, memories that are going on here. But there's a twist on that. And one of the first things that surprised me when I was watching it this week is that Robin Williams is in it, and I'd forgotten completely that he was in this movie. He plays a psychiatrist who has been basically drummed out of the medical profession and is now working at a kind of a small grocery store, and he's basically consulted by this private detective played by Kenneth Branagh about psychiatric issues. He was somebody that he had looked up as part of his job, and so he was just taking advantage of this connection that he had. I think Emma Thompson was billed like fifth or sixth in this movie. She's the co-lead. She's the main protagonist in the film after Branagh, and it was just strange that she didn't get a bigger billing. But Andy Garcia is in the movie as well, and I think this presaged the anti-smoking commercial. This is the first time I remember seeing a character smoke through a trachea tube. So it was... and the film is shot in... It was all shot in color, but the scenes that go back to the past are presented in black and white. They just desaturated the colors and turned it into black and white. And they look pretty effective, although I understand that the costumers and the cinematographer and the production design people were a little ticked, because had they known that that was going to be the case, they'd have designed things differently for the shoot. But it was, I think, a decision that Branagh made at the end is kind of a cost-saving measure, so there's probably a good reason he left them out of it. But it's an interesting story, and Will, is it one of the ones that you had on your list?
It's not one of the ones I had on my list. I've not actually seen this particular film. I'm afraid to say that the presence of Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson in lead roles kind of puts me off, because they're this sort of type of British actor that I really don't. I don't like. I'm sure David will be familiar with this term, but they're what we call loveys in the UK. I'm not particularly a fan of those type of that type of things. But there's some You know, interesting you mentioned that Emma Thompson was like sort of fifth or sixth billed despite being the co-lead, because obviously Kenneth Branagh directed this film and they were a couple. Well, they would have been a couple at the time that this film was made. So, yeah, don't quite know. Maybe that's what was the maybe that was the kind of grain of sand in the oyster that kind of led to their breakup. But I see the film is written by Scott Frank. He's done a lot of like good or sort of films that work within that sort of neo sort of noirish type of field. So things like Malice and The Lookout. And he's obviously sort of directed a couple of Wolverine flavored movies as well, but he's clearly knows his way. And he did Walk Among the Tombstones as well, which is another good.
I love Walk Among the Tombstones.
Yeah, gritty crime thriller. So maybe I'll just have to get over my distaste for British lovey actors and
Well, I tell you, Branagh's modern character, I'm not exactly sure why a guy who grew up in the Los Angeles area and is a former cop and is working as a private investigator has to have a New York accent. It doesn't make any sense. So that,
well,
that
part
was
Kenneth
a little
Branagh
bit.
Branagh is he shouldn't do accents. He's generally the one he does for Hercule Poirot is awful. Whenever he attempts a Russian accent, it's usually woeful. I don't know what the arrogance of the man. Just someone just needs to turn to just we don't care. Just speak in your normal voice.
All right, Heather, we're back to you.
All right, I'm sticking with my childhood nostalgia here, and. And I'm bringing it down too with Go Ninja, Go Ninja, Go Ninja, Go. Yeah, I'm bringing up Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles too.
Yay!
Yes, thank you. This movie is stupid good. It actually is legitimately good, I think. This is another movie that I got to see in the theater. My parents, for all their faults, they brought us so many movies, and I'm so gracious for it. One of my things that I can do, my memory's like yours, Richard, where sometimes things slip away, and I'm like, how come I can't get that back? But I've saved every movie ticket stub that I've ever had. Wow. And certainly I've lost some over the years, but this is why I really hate digital stuff now. But I can look at my ticket stubs and pull them out, and I can remember everything. It all comes back. Like the experience, the day, what was happening then, what theater I was at. I might not remember the name of the theater, but I remember the theater. I remember who was with me. It's really, really cool. This one was an event for us too, kind of like Terminator 2. My brother, my mom, and I, we went to the east side of Detroit to go meet my mom's side of the family. We went with her mom and my cousin to go see this in the theater, something we never did before because it was that big of a deal for us. And oh my gosh, we were not let down. And it was one of the few times too where we saw like a family movie or a kids movie with a bunch of other families in the theater and got to have that experience, because we usually saw adult movies with our parents. Like we saw The Hunt for Red October when we were little kids. My brother was falling asleep. It was great. But but yeah, so it was this huge experience as far as the crowd reacting together. And I mean, it's really great though. It has no business being as good as it is. It really just doesn't. But, I mean, we have a new April O'Neil, and that's one of the things that I missed. I missed Judith Hogue. I thought she was wonderful in the first film. But aside from that, the story's a good story. I mean, it's an origin story. That's what we basically get. We get to learn more about our turtles. We get to find them displaced, and we have to solve all these other things. Oh, and then we have Shredder back. Shredder! It's just so much fun. And then you have the story of the ooze. This is ridiculous. I know it's ridiculous. I don't care. It works for me. Toka and Rezar are fun and also terrifying nemesis. I mean, my brother and I, whenever we have an excuse for anything children do, we just go, babies, the babies. and all is forgiven. The martial arts in this are actually legitimately good. Oh, it's a ton of fun from start to finish. The jokes are on point. I mean, I love all my turtles. I loved the cartoon. I played the video game. I mean, it was just Ninja Turtles were just like the apex of childhood joy at this point in the 90s. And then, you know, we have the Vanilla Ice, which I'm not going to say I'm I'm a fan of Vanilla Ice, but I sure as hell am in this movie. It's so ridiculous and great. I saw a meme recently, and it said something like, this is the concert we all wish we could have gone to when we were kids. And it's the Turtles with Vanilla Ice on the stage. But it is. It's a great movie, and it still cracks me up. The cast is fantastic. And then you have, like, it's David Warner in there is playing it so straight. which should just be wrong, but what was it Kevin Nash who played Super Shredder with the giant monster body? It definitely levels up from the first movie, and it's a ton of fun, and the rewatchability of it is just incredible. And I've shown this to my kids. I have two grown children that are 21 and 18, and then I have a 7-year-old. My 21-year-old and my 18-year-old still love this movie also, so it's crossing that generation, and now my 7-year-old loves both the first one and the second one as well. So we're keeping it live. We're going to keep passing this on, so it's going to stay alive. It's great. It's fantastic.
It should be. I mean, you can't go wrong with the Turtles, man. And speaking of Vanilla Ice, when you mentioned Vanilla Ice, I thought of this funny story that I can laugh at now. I am a fan of his one hit that he had.
Yes.
And back then, growing up, there was a radio station that had like a request hour where you could call in and ask for a song and they would play it. I called and requested Ice Ice Baby and they laughed at me.
Huge.
And when they realized that I was serious, I said, no, yeah, can you play it? They hung up on me.
Oh, that is
so rude.
That was on the radio. Okay, that song is still good. It's just been played out so bad that it's hard to listen to. But that's it. It's still great. And it was on everything. It was playing cross stations and it was a rare song that actually did that. That surprises me.
That's what I thought. I know. And I felt so weird as a little kid, you know, as a young person calling the station.
Calling the radio station,
following the directions y'all said to call. So I'm calling and you hung up on me.
That's a kid as well. That's nasty. Yeah.
Ice baby.
I'm wishing bad things upon those people. Yeah. That's right.
Well,
but I hope karma got a little bite in their ass.
I will say Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles
They're mega
2
bitches.
Thank you.
Is on Laserdisc and is in my collection. I just didn't include it because it wasn't obscure enough.
I just bought the trilogy on Blu-ray recently because I took the kids to see the animated one and they loved it. So I was like, right, let's do some history. So I haven't got around to watching it yet, I must admit. But yeah, I will be soon.
Power parenting there, David.
Yeah.
Well, Nicole, I know that your heart was broken by those radio disc jockeys. How can we repair it? What's your next film?
Well, my next film is an action thriller that will blow your tits off. I chose Backdraft, about the two feuding brothers who are, you know, trying to carry on their family tradition. I like this movie. I like that they had to eventually, you know, try to come together and work together to try to solve this string of arsons and murders that are happening. But there were three reasons that I chose this film mainly. One, because it's an action film and action's my favorite genre, and it depicts different aspects of the corruption and politics and resentment that tends to happen when crimes go unchecked. And it has real special effects, which I liked, rather than like digital special effects. I read a few different articles previously that mentioned how they were setting various materials ablaze, from rubber cement and cardboard to having like gas burners on set and things like that. So it also makes me appreciate this, much like a lot of other mostly older movies. It makes me appreciate and want everyone else in the world to appreciate what actors and crew members kind of go through to entertain the masses. I imagine this was a really hot, sweaty set. Maybe not as gory and dangerous as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre set, but and thankfully not many people got injured while making Backdraft. But I do appreciate that they, you know, set out to use like real fire and, you know, set the set on fire to make this movie. That said, for a movie where they're investigating arson and murders, I imagine this would be a pyromaniac's dream for someone who's working on that set. And they have some weird extracurricular activities. The second reason that I chose this film was because I like a good film with a macho-like man. And as a kid, when I saw this, Kurt Russell was that macho man to me. Right. He seemed fearless and proud. And, you know, even though that kind of got the best of him in some ways and some scenes during this movie, which is unfortunate, but I liked watching Kurt Russell in this and just looking at tough men breaking down walls, saving people and being manly men, which leads me to the third reason that I chose this movie. I come from a family with firefighters and in different generations, and recently found out from my mother a couple of weeks ago that one of my younger male cousins, he's going to become the latest in the family to pursue that career path. So we have another firefighter coming around the mountain too. And so that might be biased or selfish. I don't know.
No,
but that's why those are three
good reasons.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I used to love this film. I haven't seen it for a while, but I used to love this film. I've always had a thing for explosions and things, which helped sell it to me. But it's got an amazing cast, and as you say, the kind of set pieces are so well done, because again, like you say, they did it for real. I used to adore this film, so no, I'm with you all the way on this one.
I just watched an interview with Kurt Russell. I love him too. Oh, Kurt Russell is forever.
Oh yeah.
He was talking about his iconic roles, and this was one of the ones he brought up. And one of the things that he talked most about was the set, and he compared this and The Thing as being two of the most difficult sets. Both for reasons, the fire was so hot and it was so cold on the set of The Thing. But he said after a while with The Thing, they got used to the cold. The fire, he's like, no, that was another story. But yeah, I can imagine it was very difficult. And that was one of the only ones that he really brought up too, so I think that's significant. That was a very, very good point on your part.
Thank you.
There was a great attraction at Universal Studios on Backdraft that was gave you a sense of what the actors must have been doing, because they used real fire, and when it went up, you would go, whoa, holy criminy, that's hot. Fortunately, the customers didn't get burned, but this was an incredible cast. I mean,
I can think of some radio DJs that could get burned.
Yeah, there you go. We should send them there.
Who's seen Backdraft 2? Anyone?
Backdraft 2?
No.
What?
No.
I haven't. I haven't, only because I just felt like, why do this? Don't do this. Don't make them. don't do this. Don't ruin a good thing. Yeah. But I'm open to watching it. Would you recommend it?
I haven't seen it, but I'm just aware of it as one of these like absolutely sort of blatant just crash grab sequels. Yes. I mean, there is some connective tissue. So Donald Sutherland and William Baldwin are in it.
Wow, I need to watch this now.
One of Amanda's favorites, Joe Anderson, is the star. So now I have to look at this and see it. Oh, Jiminy Crickets.
I had no idea.
Will, where are we headed?
We are headed to a film called Shattered. So of the films that I'm talking about in this sort of neo-noir genre, this is probably the most deliberate, the most overt like homage to the idea of film noir. So I mean, the plot here involves, you've got the kind of like central character is suffering from amnesia. You've got a femme fatale. You've got somebody whose, you know, identity is changed through plastic surgery. There are flashbacks. There's a private eye in it. So, you know, the sort of plot of this film, I'm going to go quite light on it because it's pretty tough to explain. And it's pretty tough to explain. So, but essentially, you've got Tom Berenger and Greta Sacchi, who are this couple. They have an accident one night. They kind of are in a car. They go off the edge of this cliff. Sacchi kind of escapes with minor injuries, but Berenger ends up in a coma. He's got memory loss. He has to have a sort of extensive plastic surgery. Tries to resume his life after this accident, but he's kind of troubled by these memories that he doesn't really understand. And you know, he's trying to reconnect with Greta Sacchi, who he's, you know, supposedly married to at the time. I think the thing is to say about this film, it's going to be hugely divisive if you watch this. You are either going to think this is great or you're going to think this is absolute garbage. And the reason for that is there are just some outrageous twists in this film. Absolutely outrageous. And, you know, you're either on, you either go with them and just enjoy the ride, or, you know, you might, you know, they may be hurdles that you just can't leap over. And I, you know, if that's the camp you're in, I completely understand and respect that. But yeah, if you can kind of go with it, I would say this is a really good time of a movie, even if some of the plot is absolutely completely sort of, you know, ridiculous, mind-blowing, like completely implausible. So go in, expect the outrageous and have a good time with it. That's what I would say.
I actually have this on VHS. I haven't seen it yet. This was on my to watch list. I didn't get round to it, but
Yeah. Now you have homework.
Wolfgang Peterson, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. And you got Bob Hoskins as the private eye / pet store owner, which is a strange career combination. Yeah. But you know, in a film this wacky, it's a minor detail really by the end of the film.
Yeah, I saw this film. Once again, I don't remember anything about it except that I fell into that second category. I can't quite buy the crap that they were trying to pull. David, what's in your pile of goodies?
Okay, well, my next film is a film called Scary Movie. And yes, it's not the horror spoof that came out about 9, 10 years later. It is a film directed by Daniel Erickson. This is super low budget. It cost, I did actually find out how much this cost because there's a commentary. This is one of the films that was released by Agfa on Blu-ray and the American Genre Film Archive. And it cost $200,000. What makes this one particularly interesting is it stars John Hawkes, who has gone on since to be Oscar nominated, which is interesting. So this is not one of his. He's done a few films before this, but nothing big. And he plays like a teenage nerd, even though he was like 32 when he made this. But you know, it's Hollywood. But this isn't Hollywood. But, yeah. But he's like a teenage nerd who's dragged along on a double date with, for some reason, he's best friends with the school jock, and he is on a double date with this. Slightly quirky kind of, I think she's called Barbara, is his date, and through probably about half of the film, they are just queuing to go on this kind of homemade ghost haunted house that's being put up in town. It's a big event, everyone in town is there, and they're just queuing up, waiting to go in, but John Hawkes is terrified. He's a really, really kind of tightly wound guy, and he doesn't really want to go on this haunted house thing, and also, to make matters worse, on the news there is the news that this psychopathic killer who has just has escaped from the asylum nearby and is on the loose. So he's terrified about this. He doesn't want to go in this haunted house, and it builds up the tension. And then when he goes in the haunted house, things start happening. He thinks people getting killed and things like that, and it goes on from there. And this one. I thought this was genuinely good. I liked this one. It is, although it's super cheap, and yeah, the budget shows, especially in the sound. Some of the sound recording's a bit rough, And so some of the cast, that there's although John Hawkes does a decent job, you can tell he was kind of going to go on to something better things. But a lot of the rest of the cast can be a bit ropey. But it's a nice kind of spin on the psycho killer kind of slasher concept, especially towards the end. There's a really nice twist at the end, which is quite well done. I kind of saw it coming a little bit before, but not too early on, if you know what I mean. And it's nicely pulled off. And it's although it's cheap, it looks quite nice. There's a lot of color put into the production design, so it's quite vivid, especially once you get into the haunted house. It's ludicrously over the top haunted house with really over the crazy kind of, it seems to be massive, for one thing. And it's a nice fun little film, as long as you can forgive the typical kind of super low budget flaws. It's a nice watch. I would definitely recommend people give it a shot. And also, if you get the AGFA disc, the Blu-ray, it's probably out on DVD as well. It has a fantastic commentary. The best commentaries for me are for low budget films, when you hear how these were made on nothing, and it's just way more interesting than listening to James Cameron say, "Oh yeah, I spent $7 billion on some computer geeks to kind of make it happen for me." This is everything's done on a shoestring, literally. So I enjoyed this one.
I think it's interesting. A lot of times too, you see TV shows or films, the first film, when they have a smaller budget, it definitely encourages more creativity.
Yeah.
And a lot more that you see come through the story and the actors. I love low budget stuff, because a lot of times you see cool things that you would never see in mainstream movies because of that. It inspires so many different ways of thinking outside of the box. And yeah. And that's probably why I do enjoy a lot of low budget fantasy and sci-fi too. So you have to sell it to people, and you're like, no, there's great characters and there's really, really great stories here. You have to use your imagination. But I'm with you.
Well, I'm going to have to add this to my list, because I looked up at the trivia on IMDb, and it says in 1991, the Austin City Council and mayor made a proclamation declaring October 18th Scary Movie Day, calling on all citizens to recognize the considerable contributions made by Scary Movie to the Austin movie industry. And now that I live in the Austin area, I want to immerse myself in the Austin movie industry, so I need to see its own history. There nice. We go.
Yeah, and John Hawkes claims that it was the film that gave him enough money to move to Hollywood. That kind of, although it wasn't his first film, it kind of helped kickstart him into moving over there and getting going.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, we'll go the opposite direction with my next choice, because there is a cast in this one that is not obscure. It's filled with people. Not John Hawkes, but, some pretty well-known names: Robert Downey Jr., Sally Field, Kevin Kline, Terry Hatcher, Kathy Moriarty, Elizabeth Shue, Whoopi Goldberg. Yes, it's Soap Dish from 1991, which is a comedy about the backstage mayhem that's going on a soap opera. And I know that soap operas have not quite disappeared. There are still a couple of them out there, but they're certainly not as ubiquitous as they once were. And this, of course, kind of mimics all the things that were so famous about soap operas: the over-the-top storylines, the bad soap opera acting, the last-minute changes in characters, and the insanity that goes on with the fame that these people had. It's a very amusing film. It's full of politically incorrect humor, because there is some things that probably would be looked at today as being really inappropriate to laugh at. I'm sorry, I lived in 1991. I laughed at it then, and when I was watching it this week, I laughed at it again. So sorry about all of that, folks. One of the writers is Andrew Bergman, who has written a ton of stuff and did some other films that people will like, including Blazing Saddles and Fletch, that he contributed to. He's also a director, and I know that he made some films that I liked pretty well. Honeymoon in Vegas and The Freshman were great. So I would recommend those movies as well. But this is the one from 1991 that I think people will enjoy.
Nice.
Has anybody seen it?
We all got quiet. Quiet is bad on a podcast. That I haven't watched that since I was younger. I remember my mom was so excited to go see it, and that was when we saw it in the theater, or I saw it in the theater. I think it was just me and her, but she was so excited, namely because of the cast. She loved everybody in it too, particularly Kevin Kline. And I it was definitely above my head at the time, like half the jokes. I loved everybody. Like, for me, I loved Whoopi Goldberg. Anything Whoopi Goldberg was in, I would watch when I was a kid. So I was excited. That's how I started watching Star Trek The Next Generation. That's it. That's why. I mean, I'm wearing a Star Trek shirt right now. It's because of Whoopi Goldberg. but I remember watching it going, this, I don't understand any of this. Everybody's laughing. And I think I've watched it maybe one time since then. So maybe I should, even if it hasn't aged well.
It's just one of those movies. Like I said, it was of its time. It feels very much like an early 90s film. The comedy is in that vein. It's sharp in its sarcasm, but it's sharp in the way that is really kind of mild, which I know sounds like it's an oxymoron, but I think it pretty much describes what's going on here. These characters are ridiculous, and it's just, like I said, kind of a fun dip into nostalgia. And, of course, I had it on Laserdisc, so I had to watch it. We're back to you, Heather.
Okay, so this is definitely a deep dive into nostalgia for me. This one I've also submitted for Movie of the Month a couple times, knowing full well that it's never going to get voted in. But it is one of my favorite awesomely bad movies. It is Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead. Oh, gosh. Yeah, right? Okay, so.
You just took mine. You took my pick. I'm going to switch now.
Still use it. Just add on. It's so good. Oh, gosh. It's so wonderful. It is very much so also a movie of its time. I mean, it could not be more like late 80s, early 90s, but it's definitely feeling those early 90s vibes. I was in love with Christina Applegate. I watched Married with Children with my brother and my parents all the time, but I was in love with her. I thought she was beautiful and funny and great. So I wanted to see this desperately. I begged my mom. My mom was like, no, we are not going to theater to see this. I'm like, no, I have to see this. And I very, very seldomly begged for anything. So we made it to the theater to see this. My brother came with us. And then I think by that summer, it was already streaming on TV. But once it was on TV, we watched this movie over and over and over again. It is a kid's dream. You get a babysitter while your parents are gone for the summer and the old bag dies. So what are you going to do? Are you going to call your parents in Australia and have them come home? Or are you going to try and figure it out and have a free summer? It's like blank check. It's ridiculous and it could never possibly happen. And if it did, there would be a lot of people in jail. But it's really, really funny. And Christina Applegate's great in it. She's a wonderful lead. Joanna Cassidy, I still say, I'm right on top of that, Rose, while I'm working at work to the people I work with. They have no idea what I'm quoting at all, but they used to be quoting things out of context often. She's so wonderful. And I like the relationship between them. I like that there was two main female characters and the relationship between them was so healthy and good and encouraging. And I think I even like really tuned into that when I was a kid. And I think that's part of the reason it stuck with me so much. John Getz plays a creepy, creepy slime bag dude. And then you have these other two characters. One that's played by David Duchovny. I love how David Duchovny just shows up in weird stuff in the late 80s and early 90s, just all over the place. And then Josh Charles plays Brian, which I never was a fan of Brian. I always thought Swell was way too cool for him. But the movie is silly and it's funny and it's ridiculous and it's over the top and it's what I call awesomely bad, but I absolutely love it. Love it, love it, love it. And I will pass it on to Nicole because she does too, apparently.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. But you said everything that could be said about the movie. That was actually my fifth pick. I needed something to go. It was going to be my fifth pick, but I love it. I feel like as you were talking, I'm thinking like, how were we not related, or how did we like never meet? Because I would have loved to have seen this movie in the theater. So I'm gonna live vicariously through your joy. Like you, I watched it because of Christina Aguilera. I watched a lot of Married with Children growing up, and so I wanted to see it. And I'm always looking for petty cash still today. when I watched that movie. You said it all. I think I'll just move on to my, what was this number? I'm all over the place
four.
Now with my picks. Yeah, okay. So my next pick is a comedy that I did not see in the theater, but I wanted to see it because my older cousins was talking about it, which is The Addams Family. Yeah. I like this movie. I picked it because I don't have a lot of siblings. I'm the only girl. And so my older cousins were the closest to siblings that I looked up to, and they were fans of the movie, and they saw it in the theater because they were teenagers, so they could go see it. But they would talk about it, and I'm like, I want to see this movie. So I finally saw it, I think on cable TV, maybe. And I liked the relationship, even though it's fictional. I really liked the relationship between Gomez and
Morticia.
Yes, there you go.
I've been called Morticia my entire life, so.
I really liked their relationship, and I also used to wear a lot of black. I had I don't know if it was the goth phase, but when I was a kid, when I was in middle school, up to like my freshman year in high school, I think I had a period where I wore all black clothes, black lipstick, gray eyeshadow, black nail polish and whatnot. So I was really drawn to Wednesday, and just her whole vibe. I had an annoying little brother at the time, but I love Pugsley. I really love this movie, even though it's a fictional like film. To me, like I liked that they seemed like a really, really loving family to me. And I just like them as a family. So that's why it's my pick.
I totally agree with you on everything you said too. I was just gonna second what you said. Morticia and Gomez are my favorite couple in the entire movie universe. I think they are the most healthy, wonderful couple ever. And I agree with you about the family dynamics too. And I think that's kind of the idea of it, is they have this, it's a little avant-garde. It's looks different than what we usually see, but their actual relationships with each other are really, really wonderful. There's boundaries, there's respect, and there's understanding. They all actually know who each other are. It's kind of cool, actually. I love it. That was a great pick.
All these nostalgia picks. I'm on board of all these. Yeah, this is one I had on VHS when I was a kid, and we wore it out. I used to watch this a lot. I love it. So, yeah, perfect.
And another one of those ones that has a great cast. You know, I miss Raul Julia.
Yeah.
Will, what are you going to be talking about next?
I'm potentially going to be taking in a little bit of a highbrow direction here. So the next film I'm going to be talking about is Lars von Trier's Europa, or Zentropa, as I believe it's called in the United States. So this is a film that is set in the aftermath of World War II. So the central character is this guy called Kessler, who is an American of German descent, and he decides to travel to Germany in the months after the Second World War to try and It's a bit of a strange mission. I'm not even sure he really knows why he's doing this, but he decides to travel to Germany to try and help the country rebuild. Whilst he's there, he falls in love with the daughter of this industrialist who is part of a underground Nazi terrorist group. And through all of this, Kessler becomes sort of caught up in this, and he ends up being sort of, you know, blackmailed by people within this group in order to commit some acts of terrorism. And this is a film that I remember very vividly. I didn't see this in summer, but I don't know quite how I saw this. I guess it must have been on video at home, sort of probably in 92, I don't know, maybe late 91 or something. But this is a kind of pre-Dogma von Trier, so this is, you know, that this film is just a complete example of visual excess. I mean, it's like the visual techniques on here are on display here are absolutely stunning. I mean, it's ostensibly shot in black and white, but he also incorporates color and a whole raft of visual effects. And what they all sort of create is this. It all sort of helps create this nightmare world of this notion of somebody embroiled in a situation that is just spinning out of all control, out of any ability for them to sort of kind of put a brake on what is happening to them. And you just find yourself just enveloped in the mood of this film. And I mean, this is a movie that takes a lot of its visual cues from the world of film noir. You've got a lot of heavyweight actors involved in this. The main character in this film, Kessler, is played by Jean-Marc Barr, who sort of made his name in The Big Blue. You've got Barbara Sukowa, Udo Kier, Max von Sydow does the narration, which is wonderful narration for this film. You've got Eddie Constantine, who's this sort of America kind of like emigrated to Europe and just sort of kicked around Europe being sort of an American for hire in European films for about 4 decades. It has to be said that this film, you know, given von Trier's sort of anti-Semitic comments in more recent times, this film probably sounds like a recipe for an absolute disaster. But in 1991, he hadn't sort of made these comments, and this film, you know, ended up winning the jury prize at Cannes, and it is still an astonishing film. And I as I say, I have a very, very vivid memory of seeing it back in the day. And it just left, as I say, the visual techniques that are sort of he employs in this film just left such an impression on me. Just really, you know, as a teenager when I saw this film, you know, just opened my eyes to the possibilities of cinema. So, yeah, Europa, one of my sort of standout films from 1991.
Nice.
You know, another one that I've heard of and never seen. Sounds like it's worth an investigation. Am I correct? Is it in black and white?
Primarily, although at particular moments, von Trier kind of employs sort of moments of color, aspects of color within his shots. I mean, there's all sorts of visual trickery. I mean, it's like sort of think, you know, think Lady of Shanghai by Orson Welles, but on steroids, and then with some fleeting color. I mean, it's a real sort of tour de force. And you kind of, I think it's probably why he probably did this film and just thought, you know what, there's nothing more I can do going in that direction. And that's it probably influenced his decision to sort of then, you know what, I'm going to go in this sort of Dogma direction. It's all going to be like naturalistic lights, no sets, et cetera, because it's probably the sort of culmination. If you've seen some of his films prior to this, things like Element of Crime, I mean, you can see the sort of trajectory, and he just obviously felt he'd got into a sort of dead end and decided to kind of, reboot.
All right, so this is the motivation for the rebooting, and it's certainly something that should motivate us to watch it. David, what are you motivating us to watch?
I don't think I will motivate people to watch this one, actually.
Are you warning us?
But yeah, warning, I think it'd be better. I mean, these films are not all ones I recommend. It's more just ones that I thought I would watch and talk about. But this next film is a film called The Wicked World. So this is from a director called Barry J. Gillis, who's most famous for making a film called Things, which is one of these kind of famously terrible, terrible films, one of these kind of so bad it's good, or one of the kind of worst films ever made kind of things. And this was his follow-up to that, because when that came out, although it was notoriously bad, but it kind of got publicity because of that. People were watching it because it was maybe not on a massive scale at that point, but people obviously watching it enough to get him to spare him on to make a follow-up, so he made Wicked World. I'd like to tell you what it's about, but it's a weird, bizarre, messed up film, and it's basically kind of about this elderly guy in a wheelchair who in a hospital, and you kind of hear his thoughts talking about coming up with stories about serial killers, and I'm never quite sure if some of it is flashbacks and he was a serial killer or is a serial killer, or if he's just a writer with a really twisted mind. But I didn't quite fully understand what was going on, because this film is just weird and it's messy and it's really, really, really badly made. And it's basically just a string of kind of murderous set pieces done with a $20 budget or something. I will say this, though. It does have a strangely intoxicating kind of allure, because it's so weird and it's so strange and so kind of shoddily made. It's got some, at least for the first half, I was like strangely enjoying it, but it just went on and it's very repetitive, and after, by the end, I was just like, no, just turn this off. This is driving me crazy. It does kind of change gear a little bit in the final act, and it starts to be more than just a murder set piece, and it kind of tried to get me back a bit. But yeah, I wouldn't recommend this, but if you, it is intriguing just in how bad it is and how weird it is. It's an odd film. It's also quite sleazy. There's quite a, I mean, I said this about the Andy Staris film, but this has a bit of a dirtiest kind of sleaziness to it, and this was reinforced when, again, this has some special features. This is another Agfa released film, and they've got like a commentary with the director and an interview, and they also have like an hour of behind the scenes footage, which I actually watched through. But that behind the scenes,
the movie that you're not recommending to us, you spent an hour watching the behind the scenes footage. Oh, yeah. David, well, I admire you so much.
with these low budget things, I sometimes find the special features more entertaining than the films. And but these, it just kind of almost made the film worse in my mind, because the behind the scenes footage was really creepy. Like, I don't know who shot it. The guy who shot the behind the scenes footage is the elderly kind of star. But there's quite a lot of nudity in the film. But when he's filming behind the scenes footage, he just keeps zooming in on like asses and boobs and things. And it's like, hang on. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Why are you even in the room? Like, this behind the scenes footage should not be in kind of sex scenes and things. This should be a closed set. And it's just creepy. And it's like, I just don't want to know what was going on in this film. It's just, yeah, it's just wrong. Very wrong. So that was an experience.
Well, I think you've sufficiently discouraged me anyway.
I second that, but I did enjoy the commentary.
Yeah. Oh.
Well, my next film is got probably the most 90s cast of any film you can imagine. It's got Hector Elizondo, Robert Loggia, Harley Jane Kozak, Larry Miller, Sinbad, Fred Thompson, Rob Schneider, Jason Bateman, and it stars Scott Bakula, and it's a football movie. It's Necessary Roughness.
Oh, I had forgotten entirely about this movie. I'm going, what?
Yeah, I think most people have forgotten entirely about it, although it is streaming right now. I watched a couple of things yesterday, and it came up in the next thing that was being recommended. I said, oh, well, I guess apparently somebody remembers this movie. Basically, after a series of sanctions, a university's football program has been penalized so much that they have no scholarships, and they have to form a new football team from scratch from the actual student body. and you know, they have to play their schedule, and this is not one of those films where, you know, they overcome all the adversity and become the successful team. They have one shot at the end of doing that, and of course that's going to go the way you expect it to go, but they get their asses handed to them 8 or 9 times straight, and there's a sequence in it that makes no sense whatsoever, but it's fun anyway because they've arranged to have a tune-up game against a prison football team, and of course the prison football team is filled with people who are actual current and former NFL stars. So you get Dick Butkus and Jim Kelly and a whole bunch of people like that showing up in the movie for 3 minutes for no reason whatsoever, just so they can stick them in the movie. And you get Kathy Ireland is a female place kicker. You know,
I remember that.
So you know, it is literally something that came out of 1990s comedy, and they said, who do we cast in this? And they said, well, there's that one, and there's that one, and there's that one. Let's get all of these people in this movie. And they did. It's perfectly entertaining. It's fine. There's nothing special about it. It's not really well put together, but you'd probably have a good time watching it. And I like Scott Bakula in a lot of things, and I think he's a little underrated, and I thought he was great in this movie. And anything with Hector Elizondo in it is something that I could probably spend some time with. I mentioned Raul Julia earlier, missing him. Hector Elizondo replaced Raul Julia in a part, a movie based on, you know, Presumed Innocent was the movie that Raul Julia appeared in, and Hector Elizondo plays the same character that Raul Julia played in a TV movie that was similar kind of theme, and I'm trying to remember the title of it now. I just remember that he did an excellent job doing that, and you know, some of these people are still around, not all of them, but it's interesting. It's interesting to kind of look back and see who all the faces were, and Rob Schneider is doing the thing that he did in his Saturday Night Live bit, where he's just, you know, making up the names and elaborating. He's doing the voiceover announcer for the football games and adding a little bit of commentary in there. And that's, I think, a fun bit, call back to the Saturday Night Live back when it was occasionally funny. All right, we're swinging in for our last one here. Heather, what have you got last on your list?
Mine's a little bit of a weird one, because I'm not sure how I'd feel about it now. It's Nothing But Trouble from 1991, of course, with Chevy Chase, Dan Aykroyd, John Candy, and Demi Moore. It's a really weird movie. It's a really strange movie. Demi Moore and Chevy Chase are a couple, and they're traveling with another couple, and they get detoured, and they're pulled over by a small town cop, which, you know, as we know, because we've seen so many movies, this never ends well. And it really doesn't either. They're taken not to jail, but to the house of this judge who's played by Dan Aykroyd, and he's in crazy makeup. Meanwhile, John Candy's playing various characters, and they're being detained in this ridiculous way, and none of this could ever possibly happen. And I usually don't like movies where people haven't really done anything wrong, but they're being persecuted. I don't like Meet the Parents because I'm like, Ben Stiller is a perfectly nice man. Stop doing all this stuff to him. It gives me tremendous anxiety. But, and that's kind of what happens here, but I don't care. Because it's really funny. It's really funny because John Candy's brilliant. And you do have all these other great comedic actors in it. And Demi Moore is great. She's the most straight-laced character out of all of them, and she, oh my goodness, she's in full Demi at this point too, because it's 91. She's so beautiful in it, but she's great, and it's really funny and weird. And bonus points for having Digital Underground show up and actually perform. But it is a strange movie, and it is kind of dark and nefarious. I haven't watched it in probably 10, 15 years. I added it on here so I could talk about it and pump myself up to watch it again and suffer all the anxiety that goes along with it. But I definitely think it's worth a watch.
Wow, it's got a great cast. I got to be honest with you. This is one of those times when somebody in the marketing department destroyed a movie for me, because I took one look at that poster. I said, I have no interest in this movie whatsoever. It just put me off. There's something about the poster that just suggests this is crap, and I don't want to see it. So
it
I never bothered
with
it.
You might not be wrong. I can't. I know people that like this movie too, but I also, like I said, watching it, I'm going, I know that this is bad. This is wrong, but I somehow enjoy it. Maybe it's a little masochistic. I don't know. But I think you should watch it. I wanted the people to watch it so you can tell me how you feel about it.
Well, I do own it because somebody gave it to me as a gift years ago out of the bargain bin, I'm sure. You know, it was one of those $3 movies, and I've got it sitting on my DVD shelf, but I have never unwrapped it, never been tempted to unwrap it, and I'm still not sure that you've convinced me.
Do it! It's the greatest movie ever. You must see it. You will love it. Tell me how great it is when you're done, or how much you hated it. No. Really though, do watch it. It's pretty funny. It has a lot of funny parts. It's just ridiculous. It's so ridiculous, and it continues to get more and more ridiculous throughout.
Well, you're making it closer to being a provocative choice.
It's one I've wanted to watch for a while, to be honest. I can't remember what. I think it's a podcast, another podcast somewhere. I can remember someone singing its praises. And it's one I've got it on VHS, randomly enough. I still have a pile of VHS tapes lying around. And I've never got around to it, but one of these days.
It's just a weird movie. If you're into stuff that's a little off center.
Oh, definitely.
Then I was just going to say, I feel like you might like it. So... it's definitely off center. It's definitely not for everybody, but it's weird and fun.
Awesome.
Nicole, you and Heather have been simpatico on this show. So have you got something also weird and off center?
We shall see. I do want to piggyback on Will's pick for, I think, Europa, was it?
Yeah.
The Von Trier film. I'm adding that to my, you guys are making my to watch list very long, I'll say. I saw Von Trier's other film, The Five Obstructions, and that seemed a bit interesting. It was a experimental documentary film with experimental film elements or something like that. So I am looking forward to see this movie, and I wonder if I should do a double feature with Heather's pick. that's like wrong, and so wrong. But I'm gonna type this down now. My next pick is wrong in a whole bunch of different ways, but I do think it's a good film. There are just a lot of wrong things happening in the movie. As the characters grow up and live their lives. So my next genre is a drama from 1991 called Boys in the Hood. And yeah. I chose this film because I did think that it was done well. I do like Ice Cube, and Cuba Gooding Jr. has done some nice work that I enjoyed over the years. But I think for me, Boys in the Hood, although it's not one of my favorite hood films, I will say, I won't put in, or one of my favorite like inner city films, I think that Boys in the Hood does a good job at illustrating how people can, how both nature and nurture can affect children as they grow up into adulthood. Here we have three young childhood friends, two brothers. One is a football player who's hoping to win a football scholarship so that he can escape the hood. His brother, unfortunately, has succumbed to, you know, a life of, you know, violence and crime, and he's in and out of jail. But even that brother still tries to live by, you know, some kind of honor code. And then you have a third friend who's not related to them that lives across the street, named Trey, played by Cuba Gooding Jr. He lives at home with his father, who's played by Lawrence Fishburne. And although all three of these friends have parents in their lives, Trey has his father. The two brothers have their mother. Their environment affects the decisions that they make and also how they grow up as young men, and their home life and their role models also affect their viewpoints and the decisions that they make. Luckily for Trey, he has a very present father who is illustrating good characteristics, patience, respect. His father is very calm, very reasonable man, but also very stern. The two brothers, the football player and the other brother, their mother is very is kind of verbally abusive, and she emasculates them a lot. So even though they both have parents, the quality of the parents also affect how they see themselves and how they interact with the rest of the world. And I think that John Singleton did a good job with this movie. Growing up, I used to be inspired by him and by his ability to make really good movies and popular movies so young. I think he was really young when he started gaining popularity. So I used to be inspired by that until I met him in person. And so, although I'm not a fan of John Singleton, may he rest in peace, as a person, I do like what he did with Boys in the Hood. And I do like the acting and the performances in that. And I think that it could serve as a good teaching mechanism as well for parents to watch and with their kids or for families, so that they could have discussions about, you know, like what is a healthy path, and, you know, what is a good way to how do you resolve conflict? You know, do you go and shoot someone, or do you discuss it with them, or do you try to prevent it before there's conflict? I think that it could be useful for that as well. But I only say that as an adult. Back then, when I first saw it around in the 90s, I just watched it for the comedy and the environment and the action. I live in the city, so although I'm not familiar with like gangs or some of the things that they experienced, I thought that it was entertaining to me as a kid. And unfortunately, I still do use some of the movie lines from this movie. At just maybe 2 or 3 days ago, I was on the phone with my mother, and my mother often tends to interrupt me while we're having phone conversations. And after she interrupted me one time too many, she followed up with a question right after cutting me off. And I said to her, "I'll tell you if you let me talk, shoot," which is what young Trey says to his teacher during a scene in Boys in the Hood. And she knew I was talking about. So I use that a lot. I use that with my mother cutting me off, even though in the movie Trey is just being a hard ass rebellious kid. When my mother cuts me off and then tries to then follow up with me to continue what I was saying, I use that movie. "I'll tell you if you let me talk, shoot." But anyhow, so that's my pick, Boys in the Hood.
Nice. I always had one personal issue with the film, is that it's a really good film, but the video I had on videotape, and the tape chewed up at the end, so I've never seen the last 2 minutes. It was just about finishing, and then it just went, and all chewed up. I was like, no. Still haven't quite got closure. So I need to rewatch it. I just haven't got around to it. But yeah, oh, I was always gutted about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's an interesting pick because you also picked New Jack City, which, you know, from the same year. And there was definitely, you know, you're sort of putting your finger on something that which was, you know, definitely, you know, black cinema was definitely having like a moment around this time with there were a lot of these like what you call like hood or homie movies coming out around this time. You know, it was a bit sort of, you know, reminds me a bit of sort of I guess, you know, sort of in the 70s, sort of with the sort of, you know, blaxploitation boom. But you had things like Menace to Society or Juice, you know, coming out around this time. It was, yeah, it was an interesting moment in terms of seeing stories that we don't normally see or hadn't sort of previously seen sort of on the screen at the in cinema at the moment.
Yeah, and I think for New Jack City, for me, that seemed to be more there seemed to be more exploitation happening in New Jack City for me, where Nino, you know, Nino is you know, he took over public housing and he's exploiting the people in his own neighborhood to make money, because he's for greed and those purposes. Whereas in Boys in the Hood, it seemed to be people trying to navigate like the environment that they're in, and the way that they approach they approach it in different ways, where, you know, Ricky played by Morris Chestnut, you know, he has it in his head that he's going to be a football player and like escape, you know, where Ice Cube, his character, just kind of succumbs to it. So there seemed to be less exploitation in Boys in the Hood than in New Jack City for me. But
it's definitely,
yeah,
a more thoughtful film, Boys in the Hood, definitely.
Yeah.
All right, Will, I'm going to let you talk, so you get to tell. You get to tell.
Okay, so my last pick is should be a film we're all familiar with. So it's Point Break, which came out this year. So you have Keanu Reeves as you know, the football star turned FBI agent, because, you know, that's a regular career path.
It's another, this is so 90s, it doesn't matter.
I do feel like we lost something sort of in the early 90s, where people could just make completely preposterous films and it just seemed normal, it just seemed right. Like now, I don't know, now preposterous films just seem completely preposterous. But I don't know what happened here. I mean, yeah, it's interesting, you know. I think there's definitely, you can peg it in the neo-noir tradition. Obviously you have, you know, Keanu like over-identifies with Patrick Swayze's, you know, Zen surfer philosophy, and compromises himself in terms of what he's supposed to be doing as an FBI agent. And this is just a film that is, what's to say about Point Break? I mean, it is a completely over the top film full of machismo, homoeroticism, extreme sports. It's unintentionally campy at points, you know, for all of that, it's just like wildly entertaining, however silly it gets at various points. I mean, you've got a fantastic eclectic soundtrack here, this like, you know, huge exciting set pieces. Keanu Reeves' performance is, I mean, it's pure Keanu Reeves. I mean, Patrick Swayze, this is a debate you could, like, has Patrick Swayze been cooler than in Point Break? I mean, but he's got some seriously cool performances that he can, you know, was he cooler in Roadhouse? You know, was you know, I who knows?
There but, is no limit to Patrick Swayze's cool.
I second that.
So, yeah, this film is just, yeah, it just, I mean, in some, it just really shouldn't work. Yet it does. And yeah, just a great film that I can always revisit time and time again and still enjoy it for what it does fabulously well. I mean, there really are some great action set pieces in there. There's some truly ridiculous stuff in here, but it's somehow it all works. I don't know how. It's just some films just have a weird alchemy that just bring elements that just really shouldn't work. They all collide together and somehow it makes something that is just greater than the sum of the parts. So that's Point Break, great film.
And stay away from the remake.
I refuse to see it. I love the original in all of its awful glory. It is perfectly awful and good and great, and it should be left alone.
I watched Ghost for a podcast that I'm going to be recording tomorrow, and then I immediately watched Roadhouse, and then I thought, well, why is it I'm not watching Point Break also? Because those movies were made 1 year after another. I mean, you got Roadhouse, Ghost, and Point Break. That's a 3-year sequence of films that I think if you talk to anybody about movies that they like that aren't necessarily great films but are very entertaining, there they are right there. And they've got something in common, Patrick Swayze. So, yeah, there's cool that's going on there. David, what have you got that's cool to finish off?
Well, if we're talking about films that are not great but are really entertaining, I've got the film for you. There's no Patrick Swayze in it. There is Matthew Carradas and Mark Fraser in it, and Robert Zadar. But yeah, I'm going to talk about Samurai Cop. So this is one of these films that is famously kind of... this is one of those so bad it's good films, but this one really is so bad it is good. I love this film. It's awful. It's directed by Emir Chavan. I don't know what he was thinking when he directed this film. It's filled with random ADR where characters overstate things for no reason, and like someone's on fire and it's like, he's burning, and they keep repeating like, go faster, like when they're running around. He just keeps throwing in ADR for no reason whatsoever. and supposedly the lead actor, the actors were kind of just in it mainly for their showreels. The director kept telling them, it'll be good for your reel. And supposedly eventually they just kind of went along with the ride and thought, let's just have a laugh. And but supposedly, because the film was kind of shot in bits and pieces, the lead actor thought he was done. And he went and got his hair cut for another role or another job or whatever. But he was pulled back for reshoots, so they just, we'll get a wig, and they just bought the worst wig they could find in some kind of flea market or something and shoved it on him. But the reshoots were quite often just to do reaction shots. Like, the director's obsessed with that reaction shot, so I think his film wasn't cutting together. He's like, we need a reaction shot. But they're so clunky, and they're so clearly shot in a different building completely. The lead actor is unsurprisingly he did nothing after this. Although he has done Samurai Cop 2 more recently, because the film kind of in more recent years in the kind of YouTube generation or whatever has become a bit of a cult classic, and so since then they've jumped on it and they've made Samurai Cop 2, which I haven't seen. Matthew Carradas, he was before this, he was Sylvester Stallone's bodyguard, so that's his kind of acting experience. As I say, it is terrible. There's no denying it, but it's just so much fun. It's partly fun because it's so bad. It's just easy to laugh at it, and it's bizarre kind of decisions and things. But also, I mean, to be fair on it, it's got a cracking pace to it. Like, it doesn't slow down. There's plenty of action. Yeah, the action's rubbish. But it keeps you going. There's always something to keep you amused or entertained. It just made me happy. It's rubbish, but it's so much fun. It won't be to everyone's taste. You need to have a kind of a taste for these kind of so bad it's good movies. But if that's your thing, then you've got to watch this film if you haven't already.
I was looking at the trailer a little bit. It looks absolutely atrocious. I can't wait. Oh yes, that's going to be fun.
And the plot, I never went into the plot, but it is just, it's a buddy cop movie, but one of the cops is a samurai cop, and that's it.
Of course, basically. Of course. Yeah. Well, my last film, I think, is the most obscure film on my list, although it stars two of the biggest stars, two Academy Award winners, and it's made by a filmmaker that has been, you know, somebody that I've liked quite well over the years, although I heard, I think Howard dissed him a few years ago when we were talking about some movie, because Howard disses everybody, so I'm not sure that's too unfamiliar. It's a movie called Once Around.
Oh, I like this movie.
Oh, good.
Oh,
I'm glad somebody
else.
This
one. No,
I don't know many people who have seen this movie, much less heard of it, and I think it's a very interesting film. The story gets a little odd because I'm not sure it has to go in the directions that it's going, but it's about personalities and characters, and we got two great personalities at the center of this. Holly Hunter plays a woman, Renata Bella. She's a young woman who's basically just broken up with a live-in that has told her, frankly, that he's never planning on marrying her, and this is on the day that her sister has gotten married. And she ends up looking for a job selling timeshare condos. She goes on a kind of a trainee trip, a recruiting trip to do this kind of thing, and she meets the top salesman in that group, played by Richard Dreyfuss, who is perhaps the most weird character in the world because he is incredibly likable and incredibly frustrating at the same time.
Yes.
He's got such a terrific personality when treating other people when he thinks about it. But boy, can he be obtuse and ridiculously close-minded when it comes to anybody listening to anybody else. You know, he has to be the focus of attention. He has to be the biggest deal in the world, and he can't just adjust to her family. You know, and he's much older than she is, and the family at first is not sure that this guy is for real. He's incredibly rich and he's generous and very thoughtful, but he's also just a dick at times. And the dad in the film is played by Danny Aiello and the mom is Gina Rowlands. And it's just, it's a very interesting film. Nothing much happens except that these characters come into conflict with one another. And I'd forgotten that Griffin Dunne is in the movie. He's the guy who dumps Holly Hunter at the beginning of the film. And mm-hmm. So he's not in it long, but he is one of the producers of the film. And the film is directed by Lasse Hallström, who you know, has made some terrific movies. Like I said, things that I've enjoyed quite a bit. I think he was referred to as a journeyman as opposed to an auteur. And I could maybe see that a little bit, but that doesn't mean that his films were dismissible. And I think this is one of the ones that probably has sat on the forgotten pile, but it sounds like a couple of you have seen it. So let me get your thoughts on it, too. Heather, you said you saw it and you liked it.
Yeah, my mom loved Richard Dreyfuss, so if he was in anything, we watched it. I think What About Bob came out this year, too.
Yes.
Which that's another movie that gives me tremendous anxiety, but I baby step through it every time because I love it. But yeah, I remember very little about this, but I remember that Richard Dreyfuss was a son of a bitch in it. And I was like, why do you love him? He always plays such grumpy characters. But I don't remember much until you started talking about it and it started coming back to me. It wasn't one that I loved, but I do remember liking it. And I liked Holly Hunter a lot too.
Yeah, I made the comment earlier as well, because this is the one, I mean, like Heather, I can't really remember much about it, to be honest, but I do remember, it was a film I can remember taping it off TV, but I can't remember if it was accidentally, like I taped it after something else, but it might have been, I think, to be honest, I was a fan of Richard Dreyfuss, I was a fan of Holly Hunter at the time, and I think it did record it on purpose, but it was a bit of a random, like, oh, I don't know, this looks interesting, and I just sat and watched it. But I do remember liking it, but it's been such a long time, I don't remember any details, but I do remember it kind of, it's just kind of sticking with me.
Now, aren't you sorry you didn't save that ticket? Because if you had, you'd remember everything like Heather does.
I do remember that James Horner did the music for it.
Ah, there you go. So you're on top of it.
I love James Horner.
Well, folks, those are our lists. That's what we brought for you this week, 1991, and we left off all of those big films that everybody remembers from that year. We're going to take a quick break to hear from a fellow LAM Podcasting Network show, but we'll be right back with our exit question.
What do Raiders of the Lost Ark and the Treasure of the Sierra Madre have in common? What about Goldfinger and the Spy Who Came In from the Cold, the Blues Brothers, and Silence? There's only one way to find out, and that is to listen to Howard Kasner and Pop Art, a podcast where we find the art in pop culture and the pop culture in art. For each episode, my guest chooses a movie from pop culture, and I'll choose a film from the movie from the more art indie classic foreign side of cinema that has a connection to it. So for those who want to know about Jurassic Park and Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and Son of Frankenstein, tune into Pop Art on Apple iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and other streaming platforms near you.
We're back, and we do have an exit question for the week for this episode. The exit question is based on one of the events of 1991. 1991 was the first time an animated film was nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. That was Beauty and the Beast. And the question is, what animated feature prior to this year do you think deserved to be nominated as well, maybe even to have won? And there are a lot of films that I basically looked through all the animated films I could find from the 1930s up until 1989 and 1990, and there are a lot. I'm not sure that there were a whole bunch that fit in this category, but let's find out what our cast of guests believes. Let's work our way backwards this time. David, what did you have a film that you think could have an animated film that could have been deserving of that kind of honor?
I'm a big animated movie fan, so to be honest, I could have put hundreds of films. I love animated movies, so I've just gone for a purely personal choice because it's one of my top 10 favorite films of all time, and that is Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind. I do love Hayao Miyazaki's films. I've probably butchered the pronunciation there. But I love most of his films. But this has always been a favourite of mine. I think I love the epic scope of it. It's got that kind of big epic fantasy thing going on. And it's one of these films I just get caught up in. If I start watching it, I can't stop. I just really get caught up in the whole world that's created. And I just found the drama very powerful as well. It's quite moving. It's a brilliant film. There's just something about it, that film, that I just absolutely adore. So I had to pick that, really. But there could have been so many more. I love it.
Will, how about you?
Well, Richard, you may regret asking me this, because I think when you talk about animated films, I think you're being polite. I mean, essentially what you're talking about are cartoons. And I don't watch cartoons. I'm a film fan. And, you know, as people who know me will already be aware of, I've got no time, energy, or interest in animated films, or really what they should be called, cartoons.
You've got your prejudice. That's okay.
I have, you know, this is my prejudice. They shouldn't have bothered tweaking the rules to give them any sort of Oscar recognition. So I've got nothing to offer you here, Richard.
That's an interesting take on it. I'm willing to listen to it. I'm expecting that we'll hear from a few people. David, of course, is seething right there.
I know I can
take him off the call.
Let's dump him now, that kind of thing.
I respect the fact that he's like, no, I will not participate.
Hey, he's forthright in his opinion. He's entitled to his opinion, as wrong as it might be, but that's okay. Nicole, is there a cartoon that you think is deserving of recognition, not only as a film, but one that should have been nominated by the Academy?
Yes, I do. And I am taking a different approach with this category, because some of the first animated, given that I was so young in 1991, some of the first animated films that came to mind when thinking of this question, as well as my favorite animated films they were all films that were released in later years, so they don't count. And so I know that, I won't say I know, I have a theory that the obvious practical choice would be something like The Little Mermaid, because I think it's one of the most memorable, if not the memorable animated films that had, to me, one of the best soundtracks ever made for an animation film. And the academies across the industries seem to agree when it comes to the soundtrack, since it won a Grammy, I think, and a Golden Globe and an Oscar for the soundtrack. That said, I thought about, what would I do if I was a member of the Academy of Motion Picture and Sciences and I needed to pick a film that's not Beauty of the Beast? For me, I would nominate DuckTales, the movie Treasure of the Lost Lamp.
Yeah.
Even though it might not win the award, I would still nominate this movie as a pretend member, if you will, of the Academy, because I am a huge DuckTales fan. I watched the cartoon all the time. I love Uncle Scrooge, and in this movie, he takes Huey, Dewey, and Louie off to Egypt to go find a pyramid and magic lamp in search of long-lost money that belongs to a legendary thief. Now, of course, Uncle Scrooge should talk to the folks in No Country for Old Men, because he needs to learn that going after criminals' money isn't necessarily a good idea, but that's neither here nor there. I loved DuckTales, the movie, The Treasure of the Lost Lamp. So that's a movie that I think would be deserving of a nomination, even if it didn't win.
I actually rewatched this a few years ago with my kids, and yeah, I really enjoyed this, actually. Yeah, it's way better than any TV spin-off kind of way better than most of this kind of TV spin-offs that you get. I enjoyed it a lot.
I do too. DuckTales, woo woo.
I've not seen it, but I suspect it's exactly the kind of film that makes Will feel that these are cartoons, not animated films. Heather, did you come up with something?
I did, and I did kind of the same thing David did. I love animated stuff, or cartoons, whichever you prefer. I am not offended by either. I went right with my favorite, and it's The Last Unicorn. It's so random. I chose The Last Unicorn, which is one of my favorite animated or just movies of all time. Particularly, it's one of my favorite childhood movies, and I don't recall how I stumbled upon it. I don't think that my parents were supervising at this point, but it's so dark. It is incredibly dark. And I found as a child that this is something that I definitely was drawn to. And as an adult, I continue to be. But the voiceovers in it are incredible, too. You have Jeff Bridges, Mia Farrow, Angela Lansbury, Alan Arkin, Christopher Lee. I mean, and it goes on. The list goes on. But the story is kind of wonderful. And it feels like, you know, There's something different about, I think, fantasy stories when I was a kid in the 80s and the late 70s, early 80s mostly, where everything did seem kind of hopeless. And then there was this one glimmer of hope, and you had to, like, hold on to that and go through all the horror and terror. And I had no idea that that would be so predictable for actual human life. But but I love this movie. It is dear, dear to my heart, and I will try and push it on anyone who will listen.
We had it on a discussion not too long ago. I think it must have been in the last 6 months, because I know that I included it in one of the videos that I've done, and I've only been doing those since April. So we should look for that, because The Last Unicorn was a very popular choice for that year. I think it might have been a Decade Look Back show. I can't quite remember. All right, well, I've got the film that I would name that's going to give Will a conundrum, because it puts him in an awkward situation. Look, there are a lot of films that I looked at that I thought they definitely were deserving. Snow White and the Seven Dwarves is, you know, the original long form version of a cartoon movie, but it's definitely a piece of art. I would say Pinocchio and Sleeping Beauty are also Disney films that fall in that category. There's a bunch of stuff from the 70s that I loved. I had The Last Unicorn on my list. I love Wizards, with the Ralph Bakshi film. I don't know that I would ever put it on an Academy Awards list. But here's the one that I think offers a bit of a dilemma for Will. Because my choice is Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
I knew you would say that.
It's so good. It's probably the best choice.
That was up for some Oscars, wasn't it?
It wasn't nominated for Best Picture, but it did get some nominations. And it did win some awards. Who Framed Roger Rabbit takes all those cartoons that we knew as a kid and puts them into a feature film with actors who are, you know, I guess we would say real people, and makes them interact with one another pretty darn effectively. And I love the concept. It's one of those movies that I remember vividly. I've seen it many times over the years. I can recommend it to almost everybody. I think I could even recommend it to Will.
I agree.
Well, yeah. I can't speak to it because obviously I have never seen it, Richard. So.
It's so fun.
It's worth it. It's worth suffering the cartoonism.
It's a film noir.
Yeah, there you go.
It's
a film noir with Bob Hoskins and Joanna Cassidy, two people we've mentioned on this show already.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, you're not winning me.
Do it,
That's okay, Will. You don't have to. You know, we'll invite you back on some other subject next time. All right, well, we're going to finish up here with asking people to offer some suggestions as to what they want us to see. So what have you guys got to plug this week? Heather, do you have something?
Yes, our most recent Word of Hellmouth episode will be out in 4 days. Also, you can find me at heatherbaxendale.com. That's where you can find me. My new book will be out in just a couple months. It's with Betas right now.
Woohoo!
Very
Thank
good.
Thank you. Oh,
very good. Nicole, what about you? What do you want to turn our eyes to? Or our ears, I should say. Either one.
I am currently in post-production on a weekly TV show that I produce in the Philadelphia area. So rather than plugging anything, I would like to turn everyone's ears to the Lambcast, available everywhere you get your podcasts. Look out for this 1991 look back episode.
Jay would, you know, who was the previous host of this show, would give me hell whenever I would mention, oh yeah, and I was on an episode of the Lambcast a couple of weeks ago, so listen to that. And he said, you're promoting the show that you're actually on. Probably don't need to do that.
Well, how about I'd say binge all of the previous episodes.
I'm for that. I recommend everybody do that. Will, how about you?
Well, to circle back around to the question you asked me at the beginning of this show, 20 films were made in 1991 that feature an exploding helicopter, include two that were mentioned on the discussion here today, Do or Die and Terminator 2, Judgment Day. But yeah, if you want to learn more, enter the weird world of films where helicopters explode, then you can check out our podcast, which you can just find by searching Exploding Helicopter wherever you get your podcasts. You can check out our website, explodinghelicopter.com, where you can read reviews, find out information about films where helicopters explode, or you can follow me at Chopper Fireball.
Good. And David, I'm sure you've got something that you've reviewed or want us to know about.
Well, I've got a few things to plug. Actually, I'm going to it's been out a few weeks now, but I still like to. It fits in with my theme today, so I'm going to draw people to it. And that's I posted at the end of January my Weekend of Trash. It's a regular kind of feature on the website on blueprintreview.co.uk, where I get together with a couple of other writers and old friends of mine, and we watch really trashy movies over a weekend, as many as we can possibly fit in, and I write short reviews of them. So the latest is up for that, and it actually includes a film from 1991 that is directed by the same guy who directs Drop Dead Fred. So yeah, Highway to Hell is on there, so let's check that out. Also, one of our writers, Andy Goulding, he's been posting a lot of epic lists recently, and the most recent one that he's put up is his ranking of all the Tim Burton films, so check that out. And finally, I just want to plug something that's not up on the website yet, but hopefully in a few weeks. I am hoping to bring back the Blueprint Review podcast after many years of disappearance. So, yes, keep your ears out for, hopefully, once I get round to it, the return of the Blueprint Review podcast.
Returning from its extended hiatus.
Yes, very, very extended. Nice.
Well, on my site, you have the usual updates of what I've seen in theaters recently. I went back and saw the Denis Villeneuve Dune in anticipation of our second chapter coming up next month. And that was a lot of fun. I can tell you that Lisa Frankenstein isn't worth the time of day that you spend seeing it. It's not good. So you can find out about that if you visit the site. And, of course, you've got plenty of episodes of the Lambcast that you can check into. I will also announce that we've closed the Movie of the Month poll for February, where all of the movies were suggested by me, since February is my birthday month. And the film that we will be talking about next week is the Martin Scorsese film, oh, gosh. I hate it. I hate being old. It's
New World.
The King of Comedy. Chimney Crickets. You guys, the other day we were going through a list. My daughter and I were talking about something. We were going through this list and playing a guessing game. And it came up and this film, and I said, I know the title. I know that I could name every actor who was in the film. I told the plot. I told the year. I told the movies that it lost to at the Academy Awards. And I could not find the name of the – getting old is such a bitch sometimes.
Gosh, it really is. You know? It really is.
And by the way, the movie – I did finally get it, but it took me like 3 minutes of racking my brain to get Do the Right Thing, which I know. I know. Oh, damn. It happens. Anyway – I want to thank you all for joining us this week. Cancel Kitchen Scraps for Lepers and Orphans, No More Merciful Beheadings, and cancel Christmas. I wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. All right.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Find us on Facebook, just search for Lambcast, or on Twitter, at Lambcast. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com, and please head over to iTunes to leave us a review.
Go to hell! Go to hell.
Ha 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 ha!